Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And one of the things that the Bush government clearly is not focusing on very strongly right now, it's what's going on in the former Soviet Union. I'm speaking specifically, of course, about Russia, but not only Russia. It also counts for states like Ukraine and Belarus. These countries seem to be slowly slipping back into dictatorship. Now, we spent billions of dollars fighting the Cold War, hundreds of billions, maybe even trillions of dollars, deployed hundreds of thousands of troops. There's a whole glorious history here that we heard a lot about when Ronald Reagan died. But now it seems that Vladimir Putin is taking steps, one by one, step by step, to backtrack on democracy in Russia. And Bush, well, the question is, what is he doing about it? Bush called Vladimir Putin the man he admires just recently, whereas 4 years ago, when he ran for election, he was quite harsh as to Vladimir Putin. I want to talk about this with the experts who know a lot more about what's going on in Russia than I do. So I have two very interesting experts that are coming on the air. The first is Professor Michael McFaul of Stanford University, who has written extensively on what's going on in Russia, specifically with the reforms or lack of reforms that Vladimir Putin is doing, where he's cutting back on the press, he's cutting back on independent elections of governors. And then in the second half of the hour, we have a Russian coming on the air. His name is Nikolai Petrov. He's a scholar in residence at the Carnegie Endowment, and he will talk about what's going on in his country. Is there a chance to save democracy in Russia, or are we going to go back to the days of the Cold War? If so, what can be done about it? And, of course, as always, we always welcome your comments and your questions. All you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP. You won't get better experts, I think, than the two I'm about to bring on the air. So if you have questions about what's going on in the former Soviet Union, now's your chance to ask the questions. Professor McFaul, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me start with what Putin did just this week. I understand that he is stopping independent elections for the governors of the various Russian regions. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, in the wake of the terrorist tragedy in Beslan, he announced two big political reforms. One, as you just mentioned, that governors will no longer be elected directly by the people. He is now going to appoint them. And secondly, he's changed the electoral system for the parliament, whereby now the parliament will be elected according to party lists, rather than the system that they have now, which is half party list and half single district mandates, much like our own system. In other words, people, when they go into the ballot box to vote for the parliament, they'll just vote for a party, not an individual who will represent them in their local constituency.
And Putin will control who's on his party's list, I assume.
Well, it just makes it a lot easier and more manageable for the Kremlin to control the parliament, because these parties will be Moscow-based. They won't have any ties to the people throughout Russia. You know, Russia's a very big place. So it makes it more centralized, easier for him to control.
You know, one of the things that interests me about the elections for governors is I recall how it is that the Soviet Union fell 12 to 14 years ago. What we had was there was the Soviet Union, but there were a number of states within the Soviet Union, or countries, I'm not sure what you call them, like Russia and Ukraine and Belarus and so forth. And Yeltsin came to power, Boris Yeltsin, by becoming the elected president of Russia within the larger Soviet Union. And he used that presidency really to lead to the breakup of the Soviet Union and to the democracy that we've had on and off the last 14 years. Do you think that Putin recognizes how you can sort of use a part of the whole to retain independence, and that's why he's cutting down on these governor's elections?
Well, he makes that claim. There's no doubt about it. And more generally, he has talked about the threat of the Russian Federation dissolution, just like the Soviet Union. That is most certainly one of the historical analogies that he tries to invoke when talking about Chechnya or some of the other republics that could break away. My own view is that that threat is no longer with us or with Russia. Maybe 10 years ago, one had to worry about that. But today, Chechnya is the exception, not the rule. And irrespective of what happens with Chechnya, I don't see another state or a republic inside the Russian Federation that is actively seeking independence.
So Chechnya.
But what appointing governors does, he thinks he's wrong about it, but he thinks it will help him control what happens in the regions, and he thinks it will help him have a more effective state.
Well, that's interesting. You say he's wrong about it.
Sorry?
You don't think that'll give him more effective control over what's going on in the various regions?
No, because I think it's very naive to equate democracy with weak government and dictatorship with strong government. It's a lot more complicated than that. There are some weak states that are run by Democrats, and there are some weak states that are run by autocrats. I can think of lots of places in the developing world where there's dictatorships in the capital, but they oversee very, very ineffective states. And some of them, you know, think of Pakistan, can't even control what happens within their own territory. So he, I think, is oversimplifying this relationship. And it's right to invoke the Soviet Union because we have an example of how that works. It's called the Soviet system, and in the Soviet days, these regional governors were appointed by Moscow, and that system was extremely ineffective, extremely corrupt, and eventually helped lead to the collapse of the Soviet Union.
So you think at the end of the day, with Putin appointing all these regional governors, that what will happen? Will people in the regions complain? Will they march in the streets? Well, what do you think? Where is this going to lead? I know it's hard to predict the future, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Well, first of all, it won't take place till 2008.
Okay.
So that in and of itself, in my opinion, is further evidence that this is really not about fighting the global war on terrorism, as Putin described it, right? I mean, can you imagine President Bush getting on television just a few days after September 11th and say, I am now going to fight the global war on terrorism more effectively, and here are my set of reforms, and they don't take place until 4 or 5 years later. Same with
interestingly,
the electoral changes for the parliament.
Just for a note on President Bush, he did do that with the tax cuts. He said, we're in the middle of a big recession, and therefore I need a bunch of tax cuts that will take place in 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. That's exactly what he did on the tax cuts. But that's a side issue. We'll get back to Russia.
Well, he announced that before September 11th as
that's
well.
That's true. Exactly.
He didn't use September 11th to do something that I think has nothing to do. I mean, don't we?
I agree with you.
I think he's done a lot of terrible things, and by the way, Bush also has this impulse for centralizing state power as a response to September 11th that I think has done some not very helpful things for consolidating our own democracy.
Well, I do see some parallels. I mean, it's interesting that both presidents, Bush and Putin, have used real attacks, real serious terrorist attacks, ours September 11th and in Russia the attack on Beslan, to try to cut back on civil liberties. Obviously, I don't think Bush has gone as far as Putin, but in this country, of course, we have rounded up American citizens, even at least two of them that I know of, and put them in jail without trial, without following the Bill of Rights. It's completely against the Constitution, but that didn't stop President Bush, and the excuse was terrorism. And so it seems to me that throughout history, correct me if I'm wrong, lots of dictators, lots of democratic leaders, in fact, both, have used a true, real threat to consolidate power internally and to round up political opponents.
You're right. I think that's right. And going back all the way to the founding of our country, we most certainly did that. But, of course, I would not want to make any parallel between our political system and theirs,
right.
Just a couple of important distinctions. You said two have been rounded up. Just since Beslan, they've already arrested 30,000 Russian citizens.
Really?
So the scope is different.
Let me ask you this. Are those Chechen Russian citizens or non-Chechens? I guess it shouldn't matter,
curious. You shouldn't even ask.
You're right.
Russian citizens with Russian passports. And, you know, what the color of their skin is or their native tongue, that doesn't matter. In a democracy, at least, it doesn't matter.
And I don't mean to play devil's advocate, but I guess I will a little bit. I think of, I think probably there should be an independent Chechnya, but if you look at it in the context of a civil war, kind of like, you know, our war between the states, obviously we were rounding up Southerners who were in active rebellion against the state and putting them in jail. So maybe, given that it's a civil war, maybe there is a difference. Am I wrong? Feel free to disagree.
Well, I don't think the American Civil War is the analogy. I actually think the analogy is today and what we do with people who are descendants from the region that we call our enemies, right? That is actually the parallel. Because the Chechens living in Moscow, for instance, that have been arrested, there's little evidence, if any, that they're associated with the Chechen independence movement down in Chechnya.
Well, that's a fair point. I would hope that most of the Southerners rounded up by the Yankees 140 years ago now were indeed involved in the rebellion. I mean, you're saying these are innocent people who just happen to be Chechen living in Moscow.
Yeah, and moreover, it's the 21st century. It's not the 19th.
True.
And the problem, I mean, to go through the list, the problem, yes, they've been arrested. Number one, that's a problem in those numbers. Number two, they have no recourse in the courts. They have no way to try to appeal that. Number three, they don't have, there's not an independent media, per se, a national independent media that would criticize this stuff. I mean,
actually,
in our country, thank goodness, when these things happen, at least it's a political political dispute. Fourth, there, you know, the best control on a government becoming too autocratic and too corrupt in democracies is a real opposition with a opposition party with a real prospect of coming to power. That means that those people, the head of the opposition party, be it, you know, the Democratic Party today in this country or anywhere in the world, they want to criticize and watch the incumbents in power for self-interested reasons, right? They want to come to power, but it serves a purpose. You don't have that in Russia today, so there's no check.
Let me deal with both things.
What the Kremlin is doing.
Because there's just two distinct issues. They're very important. I want to raise each one. One is the independent media, because I understand there used to be, indeed, at least in the last 14 years, there was some independent media in Russia, and Putin has gone and stamped it out bit by bit. And the second is the question of an opposition political party. Let's separate those issues just to deal with them in depth. First, let's talk about the independent media. Wasn't there an independent media apart from TASS and the Russian news service, which is sort of the Fox News of Russia, only even writ larger? Wasn't there an independent news service that existed for several years? And what's happened to independent media in Russia?
Yes. At the national level for television, and that's the most important, because if you read opinion polls, and I do polling in Russia, 90% of Russian citizens get their political news from national television. For years, in the 90s, there were three big stations. Channel 1, which was half owned by the state and half owned by outsiders. Channel 2, which was 100% owned by the state. And NTV, Channel 4, which was 100% privately owned.
Okay.
NTV, during the first Chechen War and the second Chechen War, which began again in the fall of 1999, was extremely critical of the Kremlin, both of Mr. Yeltsin back then and of Mr. Putin. NTV, to make a long story short, is no longer privately owned. It's fully controlled now by the government.
How did they do that?
Of course, but it's no longer an independent source of news.
Did they just buy it up?
To be fair, there are independent newspapers, three or four in Moscow, that I think are still critical and autonomous, but they have just infinitesimal circulations and don't have really any big impact on the country as a whole.
Did Putin
finally,
just buy...
There's only one, but there's one very important radio station, Echo Moskvy, it's called. It's still fighting to survive, but its market share again is very small.
Now, did Putin just buy up these television, this NTV? Did he buy it up, or use surrogates to buy it up? How did he take control of it?
It's a long and sordid story, but he basically accused the owner of it, Vladimir Gusinsky is his name, of tax evasion and corruption. You know, so he used the law and the courts to throw him in jail.
Got it.
And then simultaneously, while that was going on, one of the companies that had loaned money to Gusinski basically sold him out. This is Gazprom, the gas conglomerate. The long and the short of it is he used the power of the state to redistribute the assets of NTV.
Okay. Let me go to the second question, and then, and that is opposition parties. There was an election recently, right, that reelected Putin.
Yeah.
And the opposition parties did a horrible job, or at least maybe they weren't allowed to do such a good job, but Putin won overwhelmingly. What's happened to democracy in Russia? What's happened to the forces that propelled Boris Yeltsin? And for a time, at least, there did seem to be some reformers that had some power in government. Why don't they have any support today, or not that much?
Well, again, a big complicated question.
Sure.
But historically, after the collapse of a dictatorship, whether it's the Soviet Union or Serbia or anywhere, the opposition always dissipates and splits, because the thing that brought them together was they opposed a bad regime. And then when some of them come to power, they inevitably lose momentum. That happened in Poland. It happens everywhere. That's the first thing. Second, they were the ones that had to, or chose to, implement economic reforms that, in my opinion, were necessary, but were extremely unpopular. So that was the second reason why they lost popularity. They were experiencing a bit of a surge of a comeback back in the election for parliament in the fall of 1999. And a couple of the liberal parties did better than expected, and it looked like, you know, the pendulum was turning. But then the conditions for the election in 2003 were so restrictive. I mean, it's hard to run a competitive campaign if you don't have access to national television, right? It's hard to run in local constituencies. You know, let's say you're running in the city of New York, and yet the mayor of New York is fully beholden to the White House and does everything in his power to make sure that you don't have a free chance to win that seat. Well, that was the conditions in Russia for the parliamentary elections in 2003.
Had NTV already been bought up by then, by 2003? Had NTV already been taken over?
That's right. NTV
okay.
had been taken over.
I see.
The other big thing was that financing for these liberal parties had basically the Kremlin had scared everybody away when they arrested this guy, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who, you know, was a businessman, oligarch, with, you know, not a very pretty past. You know, he's no angel. He's no Andrei Sakharov. But he was providing money to some of the liberal parties, and then he found himself in jail in October, and that sent a signal to everybody else, do not get involved in supporting opposition parties.
Professor McFaul, we have to go to commercial break. When we come back, I want to discuss what the United States is doing or isn't doing or could do to help stop this threat to democracy in Russia. And I also want to take your calls. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Professor McFaul is only here the first half hour, so if you want to ask him a question, you better call in now. 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can contribute to the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back.
News, Americans. U.S. corporations say that they are no longer offshoring our middle-class jobs. It seems that they've grown afraid of the rising public anger at this self-serving fattening of their already ample bottom lines at the expense of working families. They fear that there will be a political backlash from workers, customers, Congress, and plain old American patriots. Does this mean that greed-headed CEOs are no longer shipping our manufacturing, professional, and high-tech jobs to India, Pakistan, Russia, and other low-wage centers? Of course not. It simply means that they no longer say the word offshoring. Instead, the doublespeak artists of corporate PR departments have coined new euphemisms. Rather than offshoring, they now call it remote global sourcing, or right-shoring, to disguise the perfidy. A new report finds that offshoring, by whatever name, is not only continuing unabated, but accelerating rapidly and expanding into new fields. If you're an architect, if you do legal work or tax preparation, if you're an editor or radiologist, say bye-bye to your professional position. For CEOs are putting these and many more on a virtual boat overseas, with about 80% of the jobs going to India, where they can get the work done for a third or less than they pay to us Americans. The report, prepared by Forrester Research, says that offshoring is increasing dramatically. Forrester's previous prediction was that the U.S. would lose 588,000. Now it estimates that 830,000 will be lost, a 41% increase. Nearly half of corporations surveyed say they're either offshoring jobs now or preparing to. Well, says one offshoring specialist, so what? Quote, it's free enterprise. We're trying to make money. Yeah, and so are bank robbers. This is Jim Hightower saying the proper word for what these CEOs are doing is not offshoring, it's stealing. They're stealing America's middle-class future.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first 6 payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a single pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror, my wife's still in bed, and this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about what's going on in Russia and what the United States can do about it. My guest, Professor Michael McFaul, has detailed at length exactly what President Vladimir Putin is doing to consolidate control, to get rid of independent media, to get rid of independent elections in Russia's regions. And meanwhile, our president is saying things like this. He says that Putin is a man that he admires. And he says, in fact, a year ago, quote, President Putin's vision for Russia is a country in which democracy and freedom and rule of law thrive, unquote. Shortly after making that statement, that's when Putin jailed Russian oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, hope I pronounced that right, and orchestrated the parliamentary elections that we've been talking about. I want to get to the phones, too, and let you have a chance to question Professor McFaul. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Professor McFaul. Caller, you there?
Yeah, this is Gordon from Michigan.
Hi, Gordon. Got a question or comment?
Yeah, I wonder if Michael could see a scenario in which the U.S. and Russia are juxtaposed against one another in the Middle East, possibly with Russia being an ally of Iran.
Professor McFaul?
The U.S. and Russia are juxtaposed against one another in the Middle East, possibly with Russia being an ally of Iran.
Professor McFaul?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I don't want to sound too alarmist today, but I do not, in the short or medium term, probably not, but in the long term, if Russia truly consolidates a full-blown dictatorship, and that for the last 4 years, then you got to look at, well, what does a dictator need to stay in power? He needs a secret police, he needs a military, you know, in Russian they call it the Siloviki, right? The strong guys, the guys with the guns. Then you got to look and say, well, what are their foreign policy interests? These people that the dictator would hear about what Iran was doing internally. It continues. These are the people that are trying to undermine a free and fair election in Ukraine. Hill is the enemy. And if Russia truly does become a full-blown dictatorship, yes, I think we're going to be back into a confrontational relationship, we should all remember. It's still the only country in the world that can launch an attack against the United States and kill millions of our people. There's only one country in the world that can do that. That once. What changed was the regime internally in a democratic direction. And I fear that if it changes in an autocratic direction, we're going to be having many, many more conflicts with Russia.
Gordon, thank you very much for your call. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Professor McFaul. What's your first name? Where are you from?
This is Ed from New York, and yeah. I'd like to ask Professor McFaul a question.
Sure.
I'd like to ask him, with the problems that have occurred in Breslan and Chechnya, how is that...
Is there renewed anti-Semitism?
In Russia, I would say at the level of the people, it hasn't changed considerably in the last 15 years. I do polling on this, and I think it's been fairly steady.
Steady good, steady bad.
Is that state, that Mr. Putin's state and his state-controlled television has become much more nationalistic. The kind of nationalist rhetoric that stirs up ethnic conflict. Primarily, it's aimed at Chechens now, but when that kind of language is invoked, I think that's not a good sign for Jewish people still living inside Russia. I wouldn't want to overstate it, but if you look at who have been the targets of these campaigns, whether it's Mr. Gusinski at NTV or Mr. Hartakovsky at Yukos, these are Jewish businessmen that have been singled out. And Mr. Patanin, for instance, another oligarch who's made millions and millions of dollars in the same, I would say, probably illegal ways that Hartakovsky did, he's not in jail today. In other words, there's a selective campaign, I would, against which oligarchs are singled out and which ones are not.
And you think the Jewish ones...
Are the oligarchs that are singled out primarily Jewish, and is it mentioned in the Russian press that they are Jewish when
yes.
they are singled out?
Yes. The three big... If you go back, in fact, there's an excellent book I would encourage you, anybody who's interested in this, to read by David Hoffman, called The Oligarchs. And if you go back and read that, he focuses on a set of the big, the big oligarchs from the 1990s, on a set of the big, the big oligarchs from the 1990s. Three of the gentlemen that he devoted chapters to in his book are now either in exile or in jail. Hartakovsky, Gusinski, and Boris Berezovsky. And whether... And it just, I'll just say it as an empirical fact. I don't know.
The fact, when I ask the question is, does the Russian press mention that these people are...
Yes.
Jewish?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for your call. And
are there any Muslims that are being singled out, or is it just the entire Muslim population?
It's Muslims from the Caucasus primarily so far. So Tatars... for instance, have not had the same kind of repressive measures taken against them.
Ed, thank you for your call. I'm sorry to cut you off, but Professor McFaul can only be here the first half hour.
Well, I guess I'd say this, that when President Bush came to office, he said all this tough stuff against Russia during the campaign and then abandoned it, as you rightly pointed out at the beginning of the show. But then he decided to...
Meaning fighting terrorists.
I happened to meet with the president around that time in a meeting that Condoleezza Rice organized before his first trip abroad, and I disagreed with that, his vision and his strategy, and we had a chance to exchange views, shall we say, but I could see the logic of it, right? And so he went and he met with Putin in Slovenia at the time, and then... The thing he wanted to get done was to abrogate the ABM treaty and build missile defense. And the Europeans were on his case for doing this without Russian acquiescence, so he went to Putin and he began to say the nice things about Putin. And without a doubt, without question, from people I know on both sides, from the Kremlin and the White House, they have a true friendship. That was then cemented by September 11th. When Putin called him very early in the day and said, we are allies in this global fight. Initially, I would say we got something from that. In Afghanistan, I think the Russians helped us. And in fact, I would say the Russians don't get enough credit for what they did in Afghanistan. Since then, I don't see what has been the payoff in terms of American national security interests. And now I'm just doing it by Bush's own criteria, not my own. But let's remember what Bush says are his three big objectives. One, round up the terrorists, stop the terrorists. Two, prevent weapons of mass destruction from proliferating. And three, as he says in every major foreign policy speech, promote democracy, freedom, and liberty around the world, as he just announced at the United Nations. On all three of those fronts, I don't think Putin is an ally. On the war on terrorism, I think the way that he has fought in Chechnya has inspired more terrorists rather than actually subduing them. On weapons of mass destruction, I don't see any indication that Russia has gone out of its way to help us in that cause, and again, remember Iran. And on the third objective, obviously, he is no ally in the global struggle to promote democracy. So I think, you know, it was a logical idea. It didn't pay off. It's a failed strategy.
Professor McFaul, I know you have to go. I want to ask you in one more minute to tell me, if you were president of the United States, if you were in charge of American policy, what would you advocate should be our stand against Russia? What should we do? Obviously, we can't threaten to invade. Well, what can we do?
Well, absolutely, right? Our leverage inside Russia is a lot weaker today than it's ever been. But I would say we should have a dual-track foreign policy with Russia. And by that, I mean at the state-to-state level, we meet with Putin, we do real things with them in terms of arms control and fighting terrorism. But we don't check our values at the door when we go in to deal with him. At the same time that we do that stuff, we speak out for democracy. We at least, as a minimum, tell the truth about what is going on inside Russia. And moreover, we stand with the Democrats inside Russia. You asked me earlier what's going to happen with the appointment of governors. Well, it turns out by a 2-to-1 margin that Russians don't support Putin's actions. We should be standing with those Russian Democrats, I say now with a small d, and not just pretend that, you know, we don't care about their cause. And most certainly, whether it's President Bush again or President Kerry, we can't have double standards. We can't say we care passionately about the future of democracy in Iraq, and we don't care at all about the future of democracy in Russia.
Professor McFaul, you've been a terrific guest. A half hour sure flies fast. You've
given us thanks for having me.
Great insight, and I really appreciate your appearing on the Inside Scoop. Coming up after the commercial break, we're going to hear from a Russian, get the local perspective, if you will. We're going to hear from Nikolai Petrov, who is today a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment here in Washington, but he's before then, he certainly was born, lived all his life in Moscow, and can give you a Russian eye perspective on what's going on there. And if you want to call in and ask him questions, I always encourage you to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or if you'd just like to write down what you want to say, go to the blog, www.radioinsidescoop.com. Make your comment, and we'll be reading some of them on the air. We'll be right back with Nikolai Petrov right after these messages.
Election looming, George W. is back to claiming that he's a compassionate conservative. And as evidence, he cites his centerpiece education law, the No Child Left Behind Act. This is supposed to be a tough love reform, compelling all public school kids to pass standardized tests. If the kids fail the federal government's strict tests, they'll be held back, and their schools can lose federal funding and be replaced by corporate-run chain schools. But instead of tough love, Bush's law actually is a tough luck scam, for he has callously refused to fund the reform part. To get Congress to approve the law, he had agreed to put up tax dollars for smaller classes, special teachers, tutors, educational equipment, and other resources needed for schools to improve the ability of our kids to learn and pass Bush's tests. He reneged. In this year's presidential budget proposal, George shorts his own No Child Left Behind reform by $9 billion. That's on top of $17 billion he withheld in his previous two budgets. In fact, this spring, Bush offered more of our tax dollars in the form of a bribe to try to get the government of Turkey to send some troops to Iraq than he has offered to all of America's school districts to implement his federally mandated education law. By so severely shortchanging our public schools, the Bushites can advance their ideological agenda of school privatization. As more and more schools lack the resources to achieve the passing rates required on the mandated tests, a little-known provision in Georgia's law will kick in, one that encourages states to privatize schools that fail his testing system. This is Jim Hightower saying, lest you assume that private schools will be better, thus more compatible. His own education department now reveals that children in such schools are doing worse academically than those who are in our public system. Georgia's reform is not about compassion, it's about profits.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror, my wife's still in bed, and this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about what's going on in Russia, what's going on with Vladimir Putin, the president, as he is slowly cutting back on the democratic reforms that once existed in Russia. And we've been talking with Professor McFaul. Now I have my new guest, Nikolai Petrov. He is himself Russian. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
My pleasure.
Let me ask you this. I know you're now a scholar here in the United States, but you grew up in Russia, and I'd like to give our listeners a feel for what ordinary Russians, not that you're ordinary, but what ordinary Russians were thinking way back, of course, in the days when the Soviet Union fell, throughout the 14 years of semi-democracy, I don't know what you want to call it, and now that Putin is cutting back on some of this. Are they saying that, well, this is justified because of the terrorist attacks in Beslan, or are people really concerned?
It's hard to speak on behalf of all Russians.
I understand.
I would say that at the very beginning of this troubled period of Russia's democratization, there were a lot of hopes. And so later there was huge disappointment because there was an idea that it will be needed to accept certain democratic institutions, and the next day the country will find itself in a similar position to, well, with any other democratic states. It never happened, and thus the disappointment was growing up, and it was disappointment with elections which became rather dirty, and their result in a lot of cases was predetermined from the very beginning. That's why when Mr. Putin has announced his package, reaction wasn't too active. It wasn't too angry, because the general feeling was that elections in regions are so bad that perhaps we're not losing a lot. But recently the sociological poll was conducted, and it showed that about a half of all Russians do not support this move, do not support the abolition of gubernatorial elections, which is extremely strong opposition if to have in mind how bad the regional elections look in a lot of cases.
Well, what can they do? Just say you have an ordinary Russian that opposes Putin's policies. I mean, is there an opposition party that they can actually join? Is there any danger in doing so? What can an ordinary Russian do if they oppose Putin? I mean, when the next election is when?
Well, you know, gubernatorial elections are going on all the time. So it's now only when it's planned by the Central Election Commission to provide all elections, just like in the United States, the same day. Now it's not the case, and this fall, for example, elections will go on, gubernatorial elections will go on in about a dozen of regions.
Are those free and fair elections, or does the government have its finger on the scale, so to speak?
Well, almost none of them can be considered to be free and fair elections. And, well, you know, the first thing Mr. Putin's advisors announced when he came to power almost 5 years ago was the model of so-called managed democracy. And the very idea of this model was to be sure in results of elections. And thus, the Kremlin started with promoting good guys in gubernatorial elections. Now this model looked in a slightly different way. It was like, say, well, pushing out bad guys. So instead of promoting any particular candidate, the Kremlin is now pushing out at the very beginning of the race those candidates which are considered to be bad for the Kremlin. And, well, later elections can be more or less free and fair in a sense that the Kremlin doesn't intervene too much, being sure that any particular result of these elections will be good for it.
So it seems to be that it's a slow process. There's still some democracy in Russia, but it's slowly ebbing away. Is that fair to say?
Well, you know, I would say that elections themselves is a very important element of democracy, because even bad elections are much better than the absence of elections, because even at a time of these controlled elections, it's needed for incumbent governor to report about, results of his work. It's perhaps the only way now when public politics is playing any significant role in Russia, due to the fact that at the federal level, public politics almost disappeared. There are no more influential political parties in Russia's parliament. There are no more influential politicians as senators at the Council of Federation. There are no more independent politicians. There is only one President Putin at the very top of huge bureaucratic machine. And in this system, gubernatorial elections played very important role of the playground for different political forces in regions.
Nikolai, when is Vladimir Putin going to run for re-election? What year?
Pardon?
When is Putin's re-election? What year?
You know, Putin is serving now for his second presidential term. Last presidential elections, several months ago, they were not fair in a sense that there was only one real candidate and there were no competitors at all, unlike, Ukrainian elections, which are going on now.
So can Putin run for re-election in, 2008?
No, he can't by the existing constitution. But there is the probability that this constitution will be revised, or there are some other opportunities, like, say, changing the political construction and turning to a parliamentary republic, with the probability for Mr. Putin to serve as the speaker of the parliament in this case, or another possibility is connected with this Russian-Belarusian union, and thus will be the first president of this merged state. It's still unknown how exactly the power will be transferred, if it will be transferred in 3 years from now.
You know, there are a lot of things to discuss on this issue. There is the former states of the Soviet Union, Ukraine and Belarus. There's the question of Russia's nuclear power. There's the question of them controlling the energy sources in Gazprom. And then there's the overall question that a lot of Americans ask, and that is, what is our policy towards Russia and what should it be? If you want to contribute to the discussion and ask one of these questions, or anyone else, Here's your chance. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. We're going to go to a commercial break. I know we can't cover all those topics, but that's why you have a chance to get your voice heard. 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with Nikolai Petrov right after this.
Governor Jeb Bush is out to make his state of Florida the next Florida. In 2000, Jeb used such crude political tactics as illegally purging voter lists to help engineer his brother's 537-vote victory in that election. And now, here he goes again. As one peer of Florida's GOP establishment candidly puts it, a Democrat can't win a statewide election in Florida without a high turnout of African Americans. It's no secret that the name of the game for Republicans is to restrain that turnout as much as possible. The Orlando League of Voters can attest to that. This African American civic group has played a big role in turning Orlando from a Republican stronghold into a city that increasingly votes Democratic. Their reward for getting involved in the democratic process is to have Jeb Bush's state police suddenly come knock, knock, knocking on the doors of some 50 of the league's grassroots leaders. These leaders, mostly elderly black women, find it frightening to be confronted in their homes by armed troopers interrogating them about their electoral participation. They're not charged with any crime. Instead, police say they're investigating vague allegations that some voter fraud might have occurred in this spring's mayoral election. Yet Jeb's own state police honcho wrote in a May letter that, quote, there was no basis to support the allegations, and he declared this matter closed. But it has not closed. Police now say the chief's letter was poorly worded. And the intimidating in-home interrogations continued this summer as the presidential election heated up. Jeb's police action is creating a blanket of fear among the league's volunteers who worry that their perfectly legal efforts will land them in jail. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course Jeb says that there's no political motive involved, but when asked how long the Orlando investigation will go on, police say it might continue right through November 2nd.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first 6 payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, "We eliminate the middleman"? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about what's going on in Russia, where President Vladimir Putin has declared that he wants to appoint the governors of Russia rather than allow them to be elected, where he has basically destroyed the only national independent voice, NTV TV, in the media, and where our president says that Putin is a man he admires. He says that Putin has democracy thriving in Russia. He hasn't said much lately, but we do have a letter signed by John McCain, Joseph Biden, signed by Richard Holbrooke, who's John Kerry's main foreign policy guy. All of them, 115 American European foreign policy specialists, have challenged Vladimir Putin, accused him of undermining democracy. What is going on there? Well, my guest, Nikolai Petrov, is Russian. He knows what's going on. He's a student here now. A scholar, in residence at the Carnegie Endowment, but he very well knows what's going on with Russian democracy. And if you want to ask questions, feel free to do so. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Nikolai Petrov.
Hi, Mark. This is Brian from New Hampshire. I sent you a long email. I know it's you don't probably have enough time for the show, but I wanted to say that there's not a lot we can probably do to democratize Russia when we can't even do it for Florida right now with Governor Jeb Crow and one man, one vote's about to be murdered there again in November 2004.
You know, it's interesting
about that.
Russia,
we look at Russia the wrong way, and in what's happened now, where democracy means nothing to the Russian people now, I think all roads lead to Baghdad, where this foolish war with Iraq has only further alienated us with much of the people of Russia, even the not just the former Soviet Union, are Muslim people, non-Russian people, even some Slavic people are Muslim people. Russia is largely an Asiatic country more than a European country. There's so much more I'd like to say. I mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Imperial Chessboard, about how diplomacy could have been better used instead of the military hand in these regions, and it still could be because of the largely Turkic peoples in these lands are pro-American still. They're not pro-Al-Qaeda.
Well, let me ask you this. First of all, I do think it's interesting that you raised Florida because Vladimir Putin himself has cited Florida as an example of why he doesn't need to have perfect elections in Russia. He cited Florida.
James bragged to him that he robbed Florida for George Bush.
Yeah, so it's interesting that he shares that with Bush. But do you have a question for our guest about?
Well, I was wondering, what does your guest think of America trying to tell Russians how to do democracy now when ours is so when all we think about in terms of Russia or Iraq or Central Asia or the Caspian Sea oil fields is about natural resources and not the people there, not your human beings there. This goes back to World War II, I think. We allowed the Nazis to dehumanize the people of Eastern Europe, of Eurasia, of Central Asia, South Asia. These are not hordes of people. These are human beings.
Brian, I think
much
it's
more. There's great cultures there than just oil fields and gas pipelines.
It's a fair question. I want to ask it to Nikolai Petrov. I mean, Nikolai, aren't we, I guess, Americans hypocrites here in that we're trying to democratize Russia when we have our own problems in Florida and, in fact, when we apparently care more about Russia's natural resources than we do about the Russians themselves? Are we just hypocrites here, Nikolai?
Well, you know, I would say that in international politics, almost all states are trying to reach their own goals, and it's not the case. It's not like at school where the teacher is thinking about success of his pupils. But I would say that the political development in Russia is strongly connected to what's going on in the United States, and Florida's elections played a rather negative role for the electoral development in Russia, because at that time the head of Central Election Commission told that, now we could teach Americans how to organize elections and how to count votes, and didn't tell us about anything wrong with our elections if you could not organize your own elections. But I would say that the very vision of Russia as of Asian more than European country.
Well, not more than, but just part. That's part of your heritage. I mean, that's part of the greatness of Russia too. I don't mean any. I'm not trying to categorize you people, because I'm as ignorant as many people are about Russia and Eurasia.
Mm-hmm.
We have a supposedly Soviet expert and Central Asian expert in Condi Rice right in the White House, and yet she does nothing but blindly follow George W. Bush. You could call him a mad Prince George the Second of America, or a mad Prince King George the Second of America.
Mm-hmm.
It was brutal power politics, the partisan politics of the Supreme Court. Supposedly, the judiciary is supposed to be free of politics and political partisanship, but they robbed that election in 2000. And you're right, this was a horrible example to set for the burgeoning Russian struggling democracy. You took far more risk than they have in China. And the Chinese, they just wanted to keep it to an economic democracy, I suppose it is. It's a free economic state, but it's still a Stalinist dictatorship above it all. But you people have tried to take the the universal human rights approach, that kind of thing, and you've taken many risks, and the terrorist attacks of the last couple of weekends ago that show that now you're going to, as it is a human tradition too, when America after 9/11, you're going to fold back into more authoritarian type of governance, but maybe that's a natural thing. But in America, we're no longer the beacon to you that I would like us to be. And I don't think we can't just put this all blame Russians or blame Afghans or blame Muslims or this or that. That's what I'm trying to say, sir. I think the Americans lump you all together, and that's a sad part about America. And once you get beyond the borders of America, you might as well be all Frenchmen to the conveniently ignorant people in this country.
Hey, Brian.
Most of us. You know, it's not so safe for us to travel abroad, and most of us don't want to, I suppose. Nowadays, we've gotten so ignorant of the world about us, and that's a dangerous thing.
Well,
we're becoming very much as over-nationalistic as the Germans were in the 20s and 30s.
Brian, I agree with you. We're running a bit out of time on the hour, but I want to thank you very much for your call. I think you made some very good points. Nikolai, do you have a response?
I can agree with a lot what was told. I'd like to stress only that the idea expressed by some experts like Sir Richard Pipes and perhaps Zbigniew Brzezinski in some papers that Russians are presupposed for authoritarian rule and democracy and democratic institutions are not good for Russia, it's totally wrong. And different sociological pools are showing that Russians are, their inspirations are not less democratic than in a lot of other countries of the region, of the Central and Eastern Europe, for example.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that.
Democratic elections as a school of democracy were playing and are playing extremely important role.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that. I actually had Richard Pipes as a professor at Harvard, and you're absolutely right. That was his theory, that Russia could never democratize, and I'm glad to hear that you at least think that he's incorrect. I want to ask you one last question. We only have about a minute left, and that has to do with nuclear weapons. There are still at least 10,000, I believe, warheads in Russia. There's also there may be some in other countries of the former Soviet Union. I'm not sure. Are these nuclear weapons being protected and guarded, or are these weapons likely to be sold to the highest bidder and possibly used against the United States?
I would say that these new nuclear weapons are protected, but the problem is that when facing terrorist threat, it's very hard to be sure that nothing will happen to all these nuclear weapons as well as to nuclear power stations and some other facilities which are extremely vulnerable in the situation of terrorist attack.
Let me ask you, are you optimistic about Russia's future or pessimistic or something in between?
I'm rationalist, so I'm not very optimistic, but I'm not too pessimistic as well.
Okay, and I guess 30 more seconds. What do you think that American policy should do? Are you happy with what President Bush has done, or do you criticize him?
I'm not happy with what was done, but it's quite natural. But if to speak about the influence of American politics over Russian political development, I would say that instead of putting pressure, and that's good in some cases, like in case of Chechnya, it will be better to provide more or less neutral and good analysis of what is good and what is bad with regard to Russian political development.
Nikolai Petrov, thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
My pleasure.
You know, it really is very interesting here. We have a government, the Bush administration, that talks good talk, right? They talk about promoting democracy all around the world. But when it comes to the country that was the biggest threat to the United States for 50 years, the country that we fought the Cold War against, the country that we airlifted Berlin, we saved Eastern Europe from, that the big victory of the Cold War, Russia imploded. Remember, we didn't invade Moscow like invading Baghdad. You can beat a country without invasion. We didn't invade Moscow. The Russian people themselves took over. The country imploded from its failures. The Russian people themselves took over. They created a democracy. And now, well, at least mostly a democracy. Now the country is slowly heading back toward dictatorship, and it would be nice if President Bush were to follow up his rhetoric with a little bit of strength. I know he wants to go into Baghdad. I know he wants to take the oil there. But to be consistent, I think we all have to agree that a Russian dictatorship is far more dangerous to the United States of America than any Iraqi dictatorship. We have a chance right now to help the Russian people, to guide Russia in the right direction, to help the Russian people make decisions for themselves, and our president has us bogged down in Iraq. And this is something that really is amazingly not very much talked about. We don't have any more time. I do want to say we've got some great shows coming up at the end of the week. Tomorrow, I've got two family members of September 11th victims that are going to come on the air and tell us their view of whether Bush or Kerry would be better on terrorism. These are advocates for the families, people who have been active in Congress, pushing the 9/11 Commission, seeking the truth. It should be a really interesting show tomorrow. And then Friday is the day after the debate, the day after the first debate between Bush and Kerry. We're going to give you the debate analysis that you can only get on the Inside Scoop. And I want to close, as I often do, by quoting John Kerry.